gotten more than a couple of lines, his wrist communicator buzzed.
"Yes, what is it, Mother?"
he said, holding the device closer to his mouth and ear.
"Priority call from Lorelei, you silly thing," said Mother's teasing voice. "You must be an even bigger man than you look."
"Lorelei? Put them right through," said Fool.
He'd wondered what was urgent enough for the team he'd left to run the place to call him about. Among them, there weren't many things he didn't think they could handle. He wouldn't have left the place in their hands if he'd believed otherwise.
"Tully Bascombe here, Captain," came the familiar voice. "We've got, well, not really a problem, but a situation Doc and I think you need to know about."
"Go ahead, Tully," said Fool. "Is it my father again?"
"Yeah, he's still being a pain in the butt," said Bascombe. "It was bad enough that he wanted to go over to Casino's books."
"You showed them to him, didn't you?" asked Fool.
"Sure, after you told me it was all right," said Bascombe. "For a while I was worried he might really find something to raise a stink about, but I guess he didn't. But then, he decided to stick his nose into the gambling operation."
"That's hardly in character," said Fool, rubbing his chin speculatively. "I never knew him to have any interest in gambling. Where is he now?"
"Playing quantum slots," said Bascombe. "Somehow, he got the idea our jackpots were too big. We tried to tell him about the odds, but he didn't want to listen. So now, he's trying to win a big one to prove we're wrong."
Fool chuckled. "Tully, if my father's determined to throw away his ill-gotten fortune one token at a time, I'm not about to do anything to stop him. It's just that more for the company's retirement fund."
"Well, I'm glad you feel that way about it, Captain," said Tully. There was a definite note of relief in his voice. "In that case, would you have any problem if we cooked up a way to get even more of his money out of his pockets?"
"Not in principle, I guess," said Fool. "What exactly did you have in mind?"
"Doc came up with the idea of adjusting some of the slots to take really big bets, up to $1,000 a pull," said Bascombe. "We'd advertise a monster jackpot, but set the odds so long, nobody'd have a ghost of a chance to collect on it. What do you think?"
"I don't see why not," said Fool. He chuckled, then continued, "At $1,000 a pull, I doubt anyone but Papa will ever be able to afford to play, and I have no compunction whatsoever about taking his money for my troops. Go ahead, and let me know how much he loses before he gives up."
"You got it, Captain," said Bascombe, and closed the connection.
Fool stared for a moment at the wall across from his desk. His father's antics shouldn't really have surprised him, he supposed. It was typical of the old fellow to show up unannounced and try to take charge. But, as usual, he seemed to have come up with a new twist. He shook his head. There weren't many people in the galaxy who seemed more out of place in a casino than the old man. Not that his father would ever let something like that stop him. Well, it was about time somebody taught Victor Fool a lesson, and he couldn't think of anyone who could better afford to pay the tuition. He sighed, then picked up the top sheet on the pile the two legionnaires had brought in, and began reading. Chapter 5 Journal Number 669. When a system is set up to deal with misfits and incompetence, the addition to the mix of someone actually capable may cause a greater disturbance than the addition of a weak cog to a functioning organization. This is certainly the case in most formations of the Space Legion, where incompetence and malfeasance have become a way of life. Thus, the arrival at the Legion's central training base on Messina's world of a new recruit who actually had a few qualifications for a military career was almost inevitably a recipe for disaster.
"I don't understand what I did wrong," said Thumper, sullenly. He sat on the edge of his bunk, illuminated by a single hand light in Sharky's hand. The light was shining directly in his face, which made it hard to see the others standing all around him. It wasn't hard to guess who was there, though. Everybody else in Recruit Squad Gamma.
"You're acting like an eager beaver is what you did wrong," said Sharky, exasperated. "It's what you keep doing wrong. Why you gotta set a record for the fastest run of the obstacle course?"
The other squad members stood in a circle around Bumper, adding their sullen voices to his argument.
"What's wrong with doing the best you can?" Bumper asked. "That's all I did. I like running and climbing over things. Why can't I do that when I have the chance?"
Sharky groaned.
"Because now the sergeants are trying to make everybody else run the course faster," he explained.
"If that little twerp can do it, what the farm's wrong with your lazy stinking ass?"
he said, pretending to shout without raising his voice to a level that might be heard outside the bunkhouse. There were a couple of chuckles in appreciation of the accuracy of Sharky's imitation of Sergeant Pitbull's habitual bellow, but nobody sounded in particularly good humor.
"Well, it seems to me the question is,
Can you guys run the course better than you've been doing it or not? Asked Thumper. He turned his head from side to side, not so much looking at his audience as trying to get away from the persistent glare of the handlight.
Wrong damn question, rumbled a deep voice.
Thumper recognized the speaker as Ping Pong, the biggest and slowest recruit in the platoon.
What you ought to ask is, should we stomp the shit out of this so-called Sofon for making everybody else look bad to the Sarge?
Easy there, Ping Pong, said Sharky, patting the big recruit on the shoulder. It ain't come to stomping yet. We're just having a friendly talk with good old Thumper here, letting him know how all his buddies in the squad feel about stuff.
Oh, yeah, said Ping Pong, scratching the thick fur atop his head. Well, let me know when it's time for stomping, okay?
Sure, said Sharky, with a nod.
I can't believe you guys are threatening me, said Thumper, indignation all over his face. Just because I want to do my best.
Yeah, doing your best is triff, said Sharky. But do you have to do it when it makes all your buddies look bad? If you just save it for when there's a real enemy.
We got a real enemy, said another recruit, Spider this time.
It's all the fucking sergeants.
Damn straight, said several of the recruits in chorus.
No, said Thumper, holding up his forepaws. Sure, the sergeants are tough on us, but that's because we have to be tough when the death rays start flashing. Really, guys, it's all for our own good.
Ain't no damn death rays flashing, said Ping Pong. There ain't been a Farkin war since my granddaddy was in the regular Farkin army 40 years ago. Who we gonna fight anyhow?
There was a civil war someplace out in the New Baltimore sector, wasn't there?
Said Spider.
The Legion was sent in to settle that one.
That was on Landor, said Sparky, dripping scorn. And that wasn't any real war, just a bunch of backward colonials getting excited. The only real action was when some Legion officer shot up the peace conference. Hope he got him a couple of sergeants.
Shh, Pitbull, came a hoarse whisper, but it was too late.
You got a sergeant now, you stupid farkin' clowns,
roared the drill sergeant, throwing open the door to the recruit's bunk room. The overhead light came on abruptly, catching the circle of recruits standing around Thumper's bunk like greeblers around a sweet bush. They all snapped to attention as the sergeant stomped over to the group.
What the fark's going on here? As if I didn't know, he bellowed.
We was just telling old Legion stories is all, Sarge, said Sharky, stepping to the front of the group. Trying to build up the squad's morale, you know.
Yeah, huh? Like your mother builds up the army's morale,
said Sergeant Pitbull.
You Barker should have got yourself some sleep before now, because I was going to come give you a friendly warning like. Just a little bit of advance notice of the surprise inspection by the big brass.
Surprise inspection, said several of the recruits in near unison.
That's right. You got wax in your ears, explained Pitbull. General Blitzkrieg sat down on base just after dark, and he's going to come inspect barracks at 0800 hours tomorrow farkin' morning. Make that this morning.
0800, groaned the recruits. The clock on the wall showed just a bit shy of 0400.
You got it right the first time, said Pitbull. Now, you're just lucky you got a sergeant that really cares for your sorry asses, so I give you some advance warning so you don't all get reamed out by the general. You think I'm a hard ass? Who ain't seen nothing? Blitzkrieg eats recruits for tapas with his afternoon sherry. You got 4 hours to make this farkin' pig hole look like a Legion base. Blitzkrieg gives any one of you pseudo-sophons even one demerit, you'll get it from me 10 times. Except I don't give demerits. I give punishment. You got that, you clowns?
Got it, Sarge, said the recruits.
Then, get your asses busy,
Pitbull shouted,
and be quiet about it. I'm going to get some farkin' sleep.
I don't know, man. This is some weird-ass job Reb wants us to do, said Duop. As usual, he was leaning on the back of Sushi's chair, looking over his partner's shoulder at the computer screen. How does he expect us to find out about this Zenobian guy, Levis?
Levis, Sushi corrected him. And how we find out about it is our business. We're the recon experts, and he isn't. It's an interesting challenge, don't you think? Find some way to access the Zenobians' archives and see if we can pull out info on this ancient legend of theirs.
Sure, and how are we going to know when we do find it? Said Duop. Even with a translator, that flight Lieutenant Qualdo makes sense half the time. I don't know how you think we're going to find one particular story out of all the stuff they must have written down. It's like finding one special bush in the whole forest.
Yeah, I know it looks that way, said Sushi. But we do have a few clues that will make it easier, like the name of the main character, for example. And if the story's that well known, We may find it in more than one place. It'd be like searching human archives for Odysseus.
Odysseus? Never heard of him.
Sushi sighed.
Sometimes I wonder about you, he said, looking up at his partner. Should I send you out to find a bottle of cork so I can get some work done?
Better you should send me for a couple of quarts of beer, said Duop. I know where to find that, anyhow.
Believe me, I'm tempted, said Sushi. But I've got some tricky work to do before I can kick back, and every now and then I'll need a fresh pair of eyes to look over my shoulder so I can tell whether I'm making any real progress. So you can't have any beer either. What you can do is run over to Chocolate Harry's and see if you can get us a translator. We'll need it once I find the Zenobian's archives, and we might as well have it before we need it. If he hassles you any, go get Rev to write out a requisition for it.
Duop smirked.
If he hassles me any, I'll just figure out some way to skank it. Harry thinks he's bad, but his security really stinks. I could slide into his supply depot and walk off with everything in sight, and he'd never look up from his biker magazines.
Maybe so. But don't try it just yet, said Sushi. That's the kind of thing we have to save for when we really need it. In fact, go get Rev first. He'll write an order for a translator and sign it over to us, and that's that. We don't have to explain where it came from if somebody sees us using it, and people aren't shooting us the evil eyeball when we really need to do something without being noticed.
Ah, you take the fun out of everything, Sush, said Duop. You want to sneak into the Zenobian's archives because it's a challenge, and that's supposed to be Triff. But when I want to skank a translator from supply, that ain't Triff, on account of I might get caught. I don't see no difference.
You don't?
Sushi turned around in his chair and looked his partner straight in the eye.
The difference is, there's no problem getting a translator the legit way, and no awkward consequences if somebody sees us using it. But getting into the Zenobian archives is something Rev's asked us to do, and he's a Legion officer. So he's the one who takes the heat if we get caught. We're just doing a job for a superior officer. Get it?
Maybe, said Duop. But remember back when that major botch-up was CO and the captain was gone? There was a whole big mess about whether or not we should follow illegal orders and who was authorized to give legal orders, and what happened if you weren't sure. I never did find out just what was okay and what wasn't, except I figured I don't follow orders enough to get in trouble anyway.
Well, that's one way to look at it, said Sushi. But I think I know what you're getting at. We don't know for sure that Rev has any business spying on the Zenobians. After all, they are supposed to be our allies. But how much do you want to bet that Alliance headquarters isn't already spying on them on a much wider level than we're planning to do?
Duop's eyebrows rose the better part of an inch.
Whoa, man, that's right. I never thought about that, but it makes sense. Maybe there's even somebody in our outfit doing it, if we knew everything that was going on.
Now it was Sushi's turn to raise his eyebrows.
You know what, Duop? If I ever act as if I think you're stupid, remind me of this. Of course there's somebody in our company gathering intelligence on the Zenobians. That's got to be. We're the only Alliance military outfit on Zenobia. I mean, why would the government pass up a chance like this? The question is, who is it? It must be somebody who's been with us a while. We haven't had anybody new join the company since before we got the Zenobia assignment.
Duop shrugged.
Well, it ain't us. Unless this job for Rev is part of it. Hey, you don't think...
Nothing would surprise me, said Sushi. But we're not going to figure it out just standing around jawing. Why don't you go over and get Rev to sign a chit for that translator, and see if you spot anything to make you think he's the spy? I suppose it's none of our business, but I must admit, you've piqued my curiosity.
I'll keep my eyes open, said Duop, showing what for him was an unusual degree of enthusiasm.
He winked and slipped out the door, and Sushi returned to his attempts to penetrate the Zenobian's computer network. Maybe that weird oscillation in the 1,000 kilohertz range was a carrier wave of some kind.
Hey, we just got here,
protested Ernie, sprawling full length on the bed. There was no other place in the room to sit, unless he wanted to perch on a windowsill, which was currently occupied by Lola.
What's the point of turning around and going right back out again?
Lola shrugged.
Fool's most likely to be at the Fat Chance, so that's where we go.
Oh, sure, groaned Ernie. That's halfway around the wheel, on a stinking bus, no less.
If you have a problem with the bus, think about what happens if we don't get the job done this time,
said Lola.
Or did you enjoy our last meeting with Mr. V?
Screw Mr. V, said Ernie.
But he looked nervously over his shoulder as he said it.
Here on Lorelei, the mob was as likely as not to have ears even in the shabby rented room where he and Lola had landed after their unenthusiastic return to the space station, where their previous attempt to kidnap Willard Fool had gone spectacularly awry. Despite taking the cheapest liner they could find passage on, the two freelance kidnappers had arrived on Lorelei low on funds, low enough to make finding some place to stay a real chore. After several hours of working the spaceport's bank of payphones, Lola had managed to find them a room in a small apartment building that normally catered not to off-station tourists, but to the lowest-paid casino workers, a major come-down from the suite they'd occupied and the Fat Chance on their previous trip. The only workers who lived this far from the casinos were the least skilled and most easily replaced. The powers that ran Lorelei Station saw no reason to waste much effort making their living quarters attractive or convenient.
"There's a bus stop about half a kilometer away," said Lola, looking over the battered public transit handout their landlord had condescended to lend them. "Come on, get your tourist duds on. Now's as good a time as any to scope the place out and make some plans. Besides, if we look and act like players, there's free food in the casinos. Unless you've been holding out on me, we sure can't afford to eat in any of the restaurants here."
"Holding out?" Ernie protested. "After the way you searched my baggage on the ship, you think I'm holding out on you? What, you think I keep my fortune in antique microchips built into my back teeth?"
"I wouldn't put it past you to try," said Lola. "Only reason you wouldn't do it is you're too impatient to keep your money where you couldn't get right at it if you got the itch for something expensive, and too lazy to go to the dentist, come to think of it. Which is why I want to get started now. Come on, Ernie. Let's go see if we can finish this job before the big guys get upset at us. Again."
Muttering darkly, Ernie pulled himself upright. At Lola's insistence, he changed into a sportier shirt and ran a comb through his thinning locks. A pair of outsized sunglasses completed the costume. Then, with Lola similarly disguised as a tourist, together they made their way to the nearby bus stop, hopped the clockwise local, and soon found themselves at the entrance of the Fat Chance Hotel and Casino.
"All right, put on a big smile," whispered Lola as they got off the bus. "And remember, we only have $50 apiece to gamble with. Better try to win. It's the only way we're going to eat anything better than a free lunch."
"I always win," said Ernie.
"Sure," said Lola, straightening her hat. "So tell me again, why are you taking contract jobs from the likes of Mr. V?"
Fixed smiles in place, they strolled arm in arm through the main entrance of the Fat Chance. The black-uniformed guards, actually actors impersonating legionnaires, didn't give them even a first glance. Inside, they swept through the entrance lobby, ignoring the hotel registration desk, and headed straight for the gambling floors. During the working day, Fool was most likely to be within easy view of the floor, watching his investment growing before his eyes. Assuming, of course, that Fool was in the casino at all. Lola and Ernie had found out on their previous trip just how risky that supposition was.
"Do you see him anywhere?"
asked Lola as they sauntered through the bar area. Ernie peered around the glaringly lit bar area.
"Not a sign of that guy. Hey, check it out. I always wondered where she'd gone. Didn't know she was into gambling."
"Who?"
said Lola, looking at the woman Ernie had indicated, a small woman leafing through a racing magazine and sipping on some tall, clear drink.
"I see who you mean, but I don't recognize the face. Is she a vid star or something?"
"Nah," said Ernie, scoffing. "That's Maria Delia Fanatico, hottest race driver on the Formula Ultra Circuit in her time. Broke all the course records for the Tour de Zappi when she first came up. Shocked the hell out of everybody when she retired all of a sudden, maybe 15 years ago. People figured she got a rich boyfriend who didn't want her to keep racing or something like that. I thought she was the hottest thing in the world when I was a kid. Never expected to see her someplace like here, though."
"Well, if she's got a rich boyfriend, that explains how she can afford Lorelei," said Lola. "Which we can't unless we hit a jackpot or two. Come on, let's check out the free lunch in the game rooms. Maybe our boy will be there and we can finish what we came here to do."
"Sure, sure," muttered Ernie. "More likely it'll be that damn robot again."
He glanced again at Delia Fanatico, then followed Lola into the next room.
"All right, Tuscanini, it's time for your break," said Lieutenant Armstrong, who was OD tonight. "Get up and get out of here. I don't want to see you for half an hour."
Tuscanini put down his book, Black's Dictionary of Interspecies Law, 21st edition, and looked at the clock. 0300 hours, the middle of the night and of his shift in the comm center. He stood and placed the book on the seat of the chair he'd been occupying.
I be back,
he said gruffly, and headed out the door, ducking his head on the way through. He didn't understand why the Legion insisted on having him get up and leave the comm center when he could relax even more effectively just by continuing to read. But Armstrong, in particular, was a stickler for regulations, and Toscanini had learned that arguing with a lieutenant was a waste of time. It was easier to get up, take a little while to enjoy the clear night air of the desert, and come back when it was time to resume his shift. Being of a nocturnal species had in fact worked to his advantage in the Legion, once he got a commanding officer who didn't try to make pegs of different shapes fit into identical holes. Humans seemed to think it was a hardship to stay up all night. Sergeants in particular were in awe of any sophont who actually enjoyed being awake during the wee hours of the morning, at least unless there was a party going on. Captain Jester had almost immediately rearranged Toscanini's schedule so that he could work during his preferred hours, and since most humans were sound asleep during the night, there was little reason for the Voltron to waste his duty hours doing anything more strenuous than catching up with his wide-ranging reading of human literature. As long as he was there, and awake, in case something did happen, that was enough for them. It was just one of the curious facts he had gathered about this strange race. The comm center was a short distance from an exit onto the parade ground. Fool had required that the modular unit he had purchased for Omega Company's base on Zenobia should have easy access to the outside from every point, in case of an attack or other emergency. That was smart planning, Toscanini thought. In a real emergency, he could save not only time, but lives. He came out into the base's central area and looked up at the Zenobian sky. Out here in the desert, it was clear at night, with a panoply of unfamiliar constellations visible above the campsite. Toscanini's home star was below the horizon at this time of night, but he knew that it was located in a small constellation the Zenobians called the Griff's Tail. Toscanini could see no resemblance between the group of stars and any kind of tail, but never having seen a griff, he was willing to reserve judgment for the time being. As he stood looking at the stars, a voice nearby whispered,
"Toscanini, come here quickly."
He looked to see Rube, one of the three Gambolts assigned to Omega Company. Cat-like aliens with excellent night vision, the Gambolts were also valuable for nocturnal work. Captain Jester liked to have at least one of them on guard duty during the dark hours. Of course, with no hostile forces on this planet, the value of the Gambolts was mostly in helping to train legionnaires of other species to move and work in conditions of low visibility. Still, conditions could change, and the captain liked to be prepared for all possibilities.
"What going on?"
said Toscanini, keeping his voice low as he moved next to Rube, who crouched along the side of a heavy personnel carrier.
"We don't know, Tusk,"
said another voice, the human legionnaire Slayer.
"Weird stuff out in the desert."
"Why you not reporting it?"
asked Toscanini. Having just come from Comm Central, he knew that no reports of suspicious activity had come in, nor had the base's sophisticated detection systems detected anything suspicious while he had been on duty. He knew that for a fact, because Lieutenant Armstrong was especially meticulous about recording even the faintest blip on his screens.
"We aren't sure it's dangerous," said Rube, whose auto-translator made his speech seem much more idiomatic than the Voltron's,
but Toscanini had made it a point to learn English directly so as to improve his understanding of humans, which had been his main reason for joining the Legion to begin with.
"Perimeter electronics no detect nothing yet,"
said Toscanini, peering out in the direction Slayer had gestured in.
"What kind of weird stuff you mean? Lights? Noises? Smells?"
"Faint lights, moving," said Rube. "Slayer can't even see them most of the time."
"I've seen some of them,"
said Slayer, who was wearing Legion-issue night vision goggles.
"They're sort of yellow-green, and they move real slow." "Any chance nanoids doing this?"
said Toscanini, thinking of the microscopic silicon-based beings the captain and Beaker had discovered out in the Zenobian desert.
"It could be," said Rube. "But don't the nanoids show up on the electronics? That's how they were detected in the first place, I think."
"Usually they do," admitted Toscanini. "Don't know much about them, though. Maybe some new form of them. Or maybe some Zenobian life we don't know yet. Flying bugs with taillights, maybe, like the books say on old Earth."
"Oh, that's just a story for kids," said Slayer. "The guys that write those stupid books must take a lot of drugs to think up that weird stuff. I'll bet most of them never been anywhere near old Earth."
"There's another one,"
said Rube, pointing toward the desert. Sure enough, there was a faint but plainly visible light there, plain to Toscanini's night-adapted eyes in any case. It moved slowly left to right, staying a more or less constant distance above the desert floor, then suddenly winked out.
"Well, Tusk, now you've seen it. You think we ought to go out and look where it was?"
asked Slayer, deferring to Toscanini as the most experienced Legionnaire present.
I don't know, said Toscanini. Looks undangerous, but who knowing? I go back to Comm Central soon and see if sensors pick up anything. Armstrong is OD tonight, is the one who ought to decide whether to look closer or not.
Yeah, I guess so,
said Slayer, clearly relieved that he wasn't going to be sent out in the desert to investigate, at least not yet. Toscanini thought a moment more and said,
Whatever Armstrong say, tomorrow I ask Qual if any animal on Zenobia acts like that. He going to know if anybody do.
Good idea, said Rube, nodding. You want me to come along when you tell Armstrong?
Sure, nobody attacking camp, said Toscanini. I go back on duty. You come now.
But when the two Legionnaires described what they had seen to Lieutenant Armstrong, he emphatically denied that the Comm Center's instruments had detected any activity in the desert.
I'm glad you spotted this, the lieutenant said. I'm not sure what to make of it. I'll twiddle with the instruments and see if there's any signal on some energy band I haven't been monitoring. You keep an eye on those lights, Rube, and if you see anything that looks like a threat to the camp, sound the alarm right away. But for now, my gut instinct is to watch it and wait. If anything changes, let me know right away, and I'll decide whether or not to wake up the captain. Until then, keep a sharp lookout and be ready to respond.
Yes, sir, said Rube, and he returned to guard duty. But whatever the lights were, they turned out to be undetectable on the base's electronic sensors, and after an hour or so, even the Gambolt reported that they had gone away. Several parsecs distant, at the Legion's Hickman Training Center on Messina's World, 4 dozen raw recruits waited anxiously in their bunkhouse, just as some of them had begun to gripe that the threatened inspection was another ploy to cheat them out of a night's sleep. The barracks room door burst open.
Ten hut!
Bellowed Sergeant Pitbull.
General Blitzkrieg will now inspect the barracks,
he added, unnecessarily, as General Blitzkrieg blustered into the bunk room. He was followed by a female human major bearing a clipboard and a bored expression. The recruits, forewarned, were all lined up at the foot of their bunks, wearing their best uniforms and trying, for the most part without success, to conceal their nervousness. Nothing resembling a senior officer had ever deigned to appear on the post during their brief time as Legionnaires. Even the colonel, who nominally commanded Hickman Training Center, might as well have been on another planet entirely. The recruits weren't even sure whether their post commandant was male, female, or even human. On the other hand, there was no doubt at all that General Blitzkrieg was human. Thumper had sniffed him out even before he'd entered the barracks. Thumper had grown up on a planet with a high enough human population that he knew the race well and was even fond of a fair number of Sofans from Earth. But he also came from a race with a highly developed sense of smell, and he knew the odor of humans well, especially human males who ate red meat, smoked tobacco, drank distilled alcohol, and sloshed their faces and armpits with aromatic concoctions as part of their morning ablutions. No question at all. General Blitzkrieg was one of those humans. He entered with a scowl that had been known to make strong Legionnaires quake in their boots. That, in fact, was its main purpose, and on most of the recruits it worked quite well. But as much as Thumper thought he knew about humans, he had learned very little about human psychology, and so the little Lepoid had no clue that the general might want to scare him.
I've done my job right, so he can't find fault with me, thought Thumper.
He stood at perfect attention, his uniform immaculate, his bunk made with exacting care to every detail. In fact, Thumper's bunk was even more perfectly made than the sample illustration of a correctly made bunk in the Legion drill instructor's manual. His trunk was equally a paragon of exactness. Whatever else the general might find wrong with this recruit company, and Sergeant Pitbull had made it clear that he didn't expect much to be right, there wasn't going to be anything for him to criticize about Thumper. Sergeant Pitbull had his mouth open, ready to issue another order, when someone hissed, "Now!" and all hell broke loose. As Thumper tried to turn his head to see who had spoken, the lights went out, and he heard the sound of several pairs of running feet. There was an incoherent roar from the front of the room, about where General Blitzkrieg stood. Then someone rushed up to Thumper and put something into his hand.
"Hold this," they whispered,
and before he could say a word, he found himself holding something. Even as he realized it was some kind of bucket and that the outside of the bucket was dripping something wet on his uniform pants, the lights came back on. Even then, Thumper didn't quite realize what kind of trouble he was in. Granted, The sight of General Blitzkrieg splattered head to toe with some sort of brownish sludge, foul-smelling brownish sludge, Thumper immediately realized, was the first thing that drew his attention. The next thing was the row of wet footprints and drips leading away from the general toward where Thumper stood. Only then did he recognize the same foul smell that emanated from the general was also coming from the bucket he was holding. And, most curious of all, the sludge-covered footprints stopped right at his feet.
"What the forking hell is going on here?"
roared Sergeant Pitbull, instead of whatever else he had been about to roar when the lights went out. Then he saw the general, and his eyes grew to the size of dinner plates.
"Oh, golly,"
he said, in a voice the recruits had to strain to hear, the first time in Thumper's memory that one of Pitbull's statements hadn't threatened to shatter his highly sensitive eardrums. By now, every sofant in the room had managed to grasp that something dreadfully wrong had happened. That fact was probably within the intellectual grasp of the pea-sized AI that regulated the water level in the toilets. Likewise, even the dullest-witted recruit's eyes had managed to trace the damning chain of evidence that led from the general's ruined dress uniform to the odoriferous bucket in Thumper's hands. In fact, it slowly dawned on Thumper that every eye in the barracks was staring directly at him.
"I didn't do it,"
he managed to sputter as Sergeant Pitbull advanced toward him, mayhem in his eyes. But by then, it was way too late. Chapter 6 Journal Number 675 Who among us does not take pleasure in the discomfort of our enemies? Such is common wisdom, noted by many observers. It is less frequently observed that, by choosing one's enemies with a degree of care, one can significantly increase the number of occasions on which to enjoy the pleasure of seeing them discommoded. In fact, it is likely that infelicitous choice of rivals is the cause of more frustration than almost any other miscalculation. This is as true in business as in those more personal areas of human enterprise. The subtleties of the matter are clearly illustrated by the fact that my employer, despite his lack of any salient qualities that might warn off a calculating opponent, had over and over turned uncompromising situations to his own advantage and frustrated the hopes of those arrayed against him. In fact, so improbable were his victories that the defeated party was often inclined to step right up to make another attempt at besting him. But almost inevitably, the outcome of the first encounter was only repeated in the return engagement. That didn't stop his would-be enemies from coming back for more. It was 5 p.m. Galactic Standard Time on Lorelei, but it might as well have been 5 a.m. or high noon for all the difference it made in the casinos that were the economic lifeblood of the resort satellite. The casinos were open 24 hours, and there was no time of day or night when the brightly lit gaming tables or banks of quantum slot machines were without a full quorum of bettors. Even the exotic potted plants lining the hallways of the Fat Chance Casino got 24-hour attention from a throng of gardeners and housekeepers who filed unobtrusively but efficiently through every public space of the hotel and casino, watering, trimming, cleaning up.
"What games are you going to play?"
Lola stared suspiciously at Ernie. She'd intercepted him on the way to the Fat Chance Casino cashier's window to purchase gambling chips.
"Poker's got the best odds, the way I see it," said Ernie, shrugging. "The house just takes a percentage of every pot, and the winner keeps everything else. I figure I can swindle most of the bozos that end up at the poker table here, and beat 'em at cards, too."
"Don't get too creative. If they catch you cheating, you're on the next shuttle off the station,"
Lola reminded him. She took him by the arm and led him along one of the central aisles through one of the casino's middle-priced gaming rooms. Working their way through the overflowing crowds were cocktail waitresses, dispensing free drinks to the gamblers, a time-honored strategy for increasing the amount wagered. A significant majority of the gamblers were taking the bait, guzzling down the drinks and free eats, as if they were at a permanent party. Some were undoubtedly shills, encouraging the real customers to act as if the party would never end. And here and there, casino guards in the black uniform of the Space Legion served as silent reminders who owned this casino and what would happen to anyone caught cheating. Lola stopped and turned to face Ernie.
"Remember, you're playing it straight today. If casino security comes down on you, it's your butt that's on the grill. I don't know you, and I'm not helping you. Got it? So don't go screwing up this job just as it's getting started, especially considering what's likely to happen to us if we mess up this time."
"Don't worry, kid.
I'll play it close to the vest, said Ernie grumpily.
He waved vaguely toward the nearby blackjack tables.
We gotta have enough spare bucks to keep ourselves flush.
And we have to keep from losing what little we have,
said Lola, stopping and turning to face him. She grasped him by the lapels and said firmly,
Your budget for today is $50.
50 lousy bucks, Ernie grumbled. That's barely enough to get into a decent game.
Build it up enough, and you'll have more tomorrow, said Lola. No sucker bets, nothing that'll get you busted by casino security. We've got to keep ourselves afloat long enough to get the job done, because if we don't get it done, we're really sunk. You remember Mr. V, don't you?
All right, I get you, said Ernie. 50 bucks it is. By the time I'm done, it ought to be 300-400.
Lola smiled and said,
Good. And if it is, you get to keep half your winnings to play with tomorrow. Now, excuse me, I'm going to go snooping.
She gave him a punch on the biceps and turned toward the high roller section of the casino. Odds were, if their quarry was anywhere on the casino floor, it would be there, where the action was fastest and most furious. Lola's step quickened. Even she could feel the excitement. There were a pair of guards in Legion uniform flanking the doorway to the elite playing area, but Lola whisked right past them. The casino didn't discourage gawkers in this section, as long as they didn't interfere with the play and didn't linger an unseemly long time. The way Lola was dressed, they weren't likely to single her out. Not that they seemed to be enforcing any dress code at all in this section. It wasn't unknown for someone dressed like a day laborer to enter one of the Lorelei casinos and plop down a grease-stained paper sack that turned out to be filled with $1,000 bills. There was an even more private area for those upper-class gamblers who insisted on playing their games out of the sight of the common rabble, but she wasn't interested in them. She was after Willard Fool, and he wasn't going to hide from the paying customers. As she knew from her previous visit to the casino, he spent as much of his time as possible accessible to the patrons. She'd even seen him with his port-a-brain set up on a bar table, working where he'd be visible to the players, rather than anonymously in some back office. But it didn't take more than a glance to eliminate the possibility that he was in this area. The only Legion uniforms in sight were a pair of guards at each end of the room, visible but unobtrusive. Everyone else in the room was in the casual garb of rich people on holiday, a range that ran from the garish display of the self-made to the tastefully drab leisure wear affected by old money. Then, Lola did a double take. To one side was a lean man pumping tokens into a bank of quantum slot machines. That was completely off the expected pattern. The high rollers had their own preferred games. Obsolete games like roulette and baccarat were their style, rather than the fast-moving high-tech games that predominated in the outer rooms. Never mind that the odds on the elite games were heavily stacked in the house's favor. The very rich enjoyed the risk, and they were willing to pay to be seen playing the more prestigious games. But slots were utterly déclassé. There was almost no pretense of skill to them, and even less of elegance. So why, suddenly, were there slots here in the high-priced area of the casino? Then, Lola peered more closely at the man playing the slots. There was something familiar about that face. She was ready to move in for a closer look when she noticed the compactly built man always hovering close by the slot player, never so close as to be obvious or obtrusive, but to her experienced eye, unmistakably a bodyguard. And he was looking at Lola. She favored the guard with an embarrassed smile, then glanced away, pretending to misunderstand the reason for his interest. It was a ploy that worked with most men. She hoped this guard wasn't too professional. But her curiosity was definitely piqued. Who was the man he was guarding? She shuffled through her mental database of faces, trying to place him without another glance that might alert the guard to the real reason for her interest. For the moment, she couldn't quite place him, but she was sure there was something important going on. Sooner or later, she'd figure it out. And then, she'd figure out how she could turn it into her profit. In the meantime, she might as well continue her search for Fool at the 24-hour free lunch spread.
"Here are your overnight messages, sir,"
said Mustache, bringing a small handful of printouts to Fool's desk.
"Great," said Fool, his face lighting up.
"Anything from Legion headquarters?"
"I don't believe there's anything out of the usual, sir,"
said Mustache crisply. By now he knew, everyone on the base knew, that the captain was expecting a promotion. He also knew that the promotion had yet to materialize, despite several months having elapsed since the first rumors of it had reached Omega Company at its Zenobia base.
He wondered whether it might not be time for someone to tell the captain not to pin his hopes on something that, evidently, was stalled deep in the bowels of the Legion bureaucracy, most likely on General Blitzkrieg's desk. Perhaps it was, but Mustache couldn't find it in his heart to break the news. Fool's face fell momentarily, but he quickly regained his composure and returned to business. "Any report from the team investigating last night's incident?"
"Not yet, sir," said Mustache, standing at attention.
He could have been modeling for a Legion recruiting poster, so perfect was the stance.
"They've got a fair bit of territory to cover, though. Most likely it'll turn out to be some local wildlife we haven't seen before."
Fool tapped his fingers on the desktop. "Likely enough," he conceded. "Funny we haven't seen it before, though, if that's what it is. We have guards out every night, and nobody's reported moving lights before."
"That could be readily explained if the phenomenon was seasonal, sir," Beaker pointed out. "We've not been here an entire local year yet, so we've hardly had sufficient opportunity to observe all the phases of the indigenous fauna."
"True enough," said Fool. "But Flight Lieutenant Qual didn't seem to know of any animal that might cause it either."
"Duly noted, sir," said Beaker. "However, Mr. Qual is a military person by profession, not a naturalist, nor is he native to this region of his planet. He may be no more familiar with its denizens than we are."
"I guess that makes sense," said Fool. "Still, I'd be happier if we got some kind of definitive result from our search. If we don't, I may have to station a team out in the desert after dark to see what they can find out, and I don't like doing that when I don't know whether I'm putting them in danger."
Mustache said, "Sir, if I may comment."
He paused briefly, and at Fool's nod continued.
"If whatever made those lights is dangerous, there is no reason to think it's any less so in broad daylight. If our search team finds nothing today, I myself would not hesitate to send them out again at night. The camp's safety is an overriding issue, sir."
"Thank you, Mustache. The point's well taken," said Fool. He stood up and paced, thinking, then turned and said, "In fact, I think we ought to plan for that. First..." He was interrupted by the buzz of his wrist communicator. "Yes, Mother, what is it?"
"Code red, sweetie,"
came the familiar voice with an edge of urgency Fool hadn't heard before.
"Code red?"
he asked, feeling stupid.
"But that means..."
Mother's answer removed any doubt.
"The desert search team is under attack."
"All right, you slobs, come get your assignments to your new units,"
bellowed Sergeant Pitbull. He waved a thick sheaf of Regulation Legion envelopes in his hand, presumably one for each of the recruits in his platoon. The recruits came to their feet in an excited babble of voices. This was the moment they'd all been waiting for, the next step in their Legion careers. It meant, for one thing, that the recruits would now go on to the specialized training they'd requested when they joined the Legion, rather than an endless round of bodybuilding exercises and mindless drills under Pitbull's relentless eye. In fact, for most of them, just getting away from Pitbull was sufficient cause for celebration. Whatever else Legion life held for them, it was likely to be an improvement over basic training. Thumper rose to his feet without particular enthusiasm. Whatever camaraderie he'd felt for his fellow recruits had vanished when he'd realized what had happened to him during General Blitzkrieg's inspection visit. Somebody had deliberately set him up to take the blame for the insult to the general. Possibly more than one somebody had set him up, in fact. He'd spent a long time trying to plead his innocence, and a longer time in a punishment detail. He suspected that only his perfect record in all the exercises leading up to the incident with the general had kept him from being drummed out of the Legion then and there, but Sergeant Pitbull had made it amply clear that the consequences were far from over, and one of those consequences was almost certainly going to be reflected in his first assignment. Now it looked as if there was no chance for him to end up in the elite unit he'd requested upon enlistment. Pitbull read each recruit's name and their assignments as he handed them their letters.
"Popper, Fort Kaboom!" he barked.
Popper, a dumpy, short-sighted humanoid from Tau Ceti IV, beamed. Ever since he'd arrived in camp, he'd been talking about how much he enjoyed blowing things up. Now, at the Legion's Demolitions Training School, he'd get a chance to do it on a grand scale.
"Spider, you're on Team Regulus," said Pitbull.
This was a good assignment, too, and fit Spider's personality. Team Regulus was the Legion's home guard unit, sharing ceremonial duties at Alliance headquarters with elite groups from the regular army and Starfleet. The assignment had more to do with spit and polish than with fighting ability, but that made it all the more a plum for many Legionnaires. Several of the recruits were sent to advanced training in various behind-the-line specialties, but at least half of them went to advanced combat training with frontline units. This was the core of the Legion's mission, of course, and Thumper had nurtured hopes, even after the disaster with General Blitzkrieg, of getting into an outfit where he could prove his worth again from the ground up, despite the fact that, as far as he knew, there were no ongoing wars anywhere in Alliance territory in which to display his martial prowess. After most of the names had been read, Thumper began to suspect that Pitbull was saving his name for last. He'd seen him shuffle through the envelopes, obviously picking the order in which he wanted to announce assignments. This was annoying, but there was nothing Thumper could really do about it. Until the recruits were placed on a transport ship to their new units, Pitbull was still their immediate superior and could order them around as he saw fit. Being a drill instructor, he usually saw fit to do so in the most sadistic way possible. This batch of recruits would soon be gone from Messina's world and Legion boot camp forever, or so they devoutly hoped. But Pitbull wasn't about to pass up his final opportunity to torture and humiliate them. Finally, the last envelope was in the sergeant's hand. He grinned crookedly and held it up to the light. By now, all the recruits were aware whose envelope it was, and curiosity was even stronger than their excitement over their own assignments. Pitbull waited for silence, then announced with a flourish,
"Thumper! Omega Company!"
Omega Company? Thumper was stunned. As short a time as they'd been in the Legion, all the recruits had heard rumors about Omega Company. Once the dumping ground for all the misfits and malcontents of the Legion, it had been taken over by a new commander, who reportedly had turned it around. Omega Company was in the news. In this boring interval between real fighting action, it was getting sent to interesting places. It was exactly the sort of assignment Thumper had hoped for.
"Excuse me, Sergeant. Is that correct?"
"You're bleepin' A, it's correct, recruit," Pitbull roared. "The general insisted on it, and that's right where your sorry ass is going. That concludes the assignments. As you were, you slobs, don't let me catch anybody goofing off. I can still hand out punishment detail."
And Pitbull turned on his heel and stalked away.
Under attack!
Suddenly, Fool's adrenaline began to surge, and the focus of his attention narrowed to a pinpoint.
"Attack by whom? Can you patch them through to me?"
"I couldn't hear who the attackers were," said Mother. "All I got was a message from the team saying that somebody or something was attacking them. There was a lot of noise, but I couldn't tell exactly what was happening. The signal keeps breaking up, and I don't think they have a whole lot of time to chat with us anyway. But hold on, I'll see if I can raise them again and put you through."
"I'll be ready," said Fool.
He became aware that he was on his feet, although he had no memory of rising from his desk chair. In the corridor outside his office, he could hear the sound of running feet.
"Meanwhile, sound general quarters," he ordered. "I want every available member of the company ready to go bail them out."
He turned to Mustache and Beaker, who had both heard the entire conversation. "Sergeant, get a relief party together without delay. I'll give you your orders as soon as I know what needs to be done. Beaker, grab me those stereoculars. We're going out to see if we can spot anything."
"Yes, sir,"
said the two men, practically in unison, but Fool was already out the doorway, running at top speed. Turning to a shelf just behind the captain's desk, Beaker picked the stereoculars in their case and followed him out the door, a step behind Mustache. Somewhere down the corridor, an alarm was sounding. Outside, Beaker could see that word of the attack had already gotten out. A small pack of Legionnaires was milling about on the south edge of the base, many of them carrying weapons and wearing helmets, others looking as if they'd been dragged out of the showers by the alert. Spotting them, Mustache nodded and strode off purposefully in their direction. For his part, Fool was sprinting toward a short observation tower at the center of the base. Again, Beaker followed, attempting to make as much speed as he could without abandoning the last vestiges of dignity. By the time the butler reached the base of the tower, Fool was already at its top, shading his eyes with one hand and staring out into the desert. Resignedly, Beaker put the strap of the stereoculars case over his shoulder and began climbing the ladder. Below, he could hear voices shouting, and a vibration in the ladder indicated that someone else was climbing up behind him. Gritting his teeth, he finished the climb and put the case in Fool's outstretched hand. Looking to the south, just over a kilometer away, he saw a small cloud of dust, or was it smoke, along a line of native trees, but nothing else he could clearly identify.
"What can you make out, Captain?" said Lieutenant Armstrong, who was the one who'd followed Beaker up the ladder.
"Not much yet," said Fool, peering through the stereoculars. "Hard to see through the heat haze and dust."
He was interrupted by his communicator's buzz.
"Jester here, go ahead," he said,
lowering the stereoculars and boosting the volume so the others on the tower could hear clearly.
"I'm getting a signal from the desert search team, Captain,"
said Mother's voice, now more urgent than sultry.
"Stand by."
Captain, do you read me?
A voice crackled through the speaker. It had the kind of mechanical inflection characteristic of an auto-translator, and Beaker thought he recognized it as Spartacus, one of the two Synthians with the company. Slug-like aliens, they were dependent on mechanical transportation to keep up with their fellow legionnaires of other species. Fool had discovered the glide boards, a common children's anti-grav toy, gave them maximum mobility at a bargain price.
"Loud and clear, Spartacus," said Fool. "What's your situation there? Anybody hurt?"
There was a blare of noise that Fool couldn't quite identify. Then Spartacus's voice came through again.
"Has us treed. Don't. Hostile Sophont, oh."
More noise drowned out whatever Spartacus said. "There shouldn't be this much interference over such a short distance," muttered Armstrong. "If it weren't for that damn stand of trees and all the dust, I think we could see them directly from here."
"Spartacus, I can barely follow you," said Fool, raising the communicator to his mouth again. "If you can hear this, just hold tight. Don't fire unless fired upon. I'm sending out a rescue party. Do you read?"
"Captain,"
came the Synthian's voice in a cloud of static.
"All right, Mr. Armstrong, I'm going to lead the relief party," said Fool, thumbing the communicator's off button.
"With comm on the fritz, we'll have to rely on visual signals. If I fire a green flare, everything's under control. If I fire a white one, send the auto dock. A red one..." He paused.
"Yes, sir," said Armstrong. "A red one means..."
"I'm hoping I won't need a red one," said Fool. "But if you see it, come after us as fast as possible with everything you've got."
He tucked the stereoculars under his arm and began climbing down the ladder, two rungs at a stride.
"Victor Fool,"
said Lola, staring at the readout of the hotel room's netlink.
"That's the fellow playing on the high-priced slots."
She'd run a routine image-based search on the stealth cam image she'd acquired of the man she'd met in the casino, but she knew better than to expect any clear result. To her surprise, it had given her an 83% positive ID almost at once. Victor Fool, munitions tycoon.
"Stuck-up-looking old bugger," muttered Ernie, lying back on the hotel bed and peering around Lola's shoulder at the computer screen.
"More to the point, he's the father of the man we're looking to grab," said Lola, pointing at the text underneath the picture. "Not to overlook the fact that he's one of the wealthiest men in the galaxy. You can think what you want about him, but he can afford to be stuck up, and we can't afford to ignore what it must mean for him to be here."
"Okay, I'll bite," said Ernie, managing to look somewhat more interested. "What do you think it means that he's here on Lorelei? Rich guys like to gamble, too, like I've been telling you, Lola. If you'd give me enough money to get into a few of the big money games..."
"Oh, encapsulate it," said Lola. "The point is, there can only be a few possible reasons why he'd be at the casino, and the most likely is that young fool himself is out of commission somehow. In fact, that would explain why the casino had set up that robot to impersonate him."
"Maybe," said Ernie, sitting up on the edge of the bed. "But what about all those news tapes we keep seeing of Captain Jester at the Landor Amusement Park, and Captain Jester greeting those mechanical beings on some three-for-a-buck planet way the hell off the main space lanes? Those can't all be fakes, can they?"
Lola frowned.
"Well, maybe not all of them. But one thing I've learned over the years, when you want to find out what's really going on in some racket, always look at where the money comes from and who it goes to. We all know that that chance is the place where one enormous pile of money comes from, and if the people it goes to aren't right here to make sure they get what's coming to them, they're too stupid to deserve any of it. That means Willard Fool has got to be here somewhere. All we have to do is figure out where, and then make our snatch."
"Yeah, like it's that easy," said Ernie. "Why don't we snatch the old man instead? Hell, he's got more bucks than the kid, and he ain't got the whole army guarding him either."
He began picking at an annoying nose hair, squinting at himself in the bedside mirror.
"Oh, stop that,"
said Lola, swatting at his hand. Then, recalling her encounter with Victor Fool, she added,
"And don't be sure the old man'd be so easy to snatch. When I spotted him, he had at least one obvious bodyguard with him, and I don't know how many more that I didn't spot. The man can afford the best, and he's in a business where he probably has plenty of job applicants with relevant experience. And I wouldn't bet a nickel that the Legion guards don't have special instructions about keeping an eye on their boss's father, either."
"No bet," conceded Ernie.
Then, turning his hands palms up and spreading them apart, he said,
"But if the job's that tough, what the hell are we even doing here? We ought to just head for the most back-ass planet on the map, or maybe even off the map, and go to cover. I don't see no percentage in sticking around here if we can't do the job. especially with the enforcers looking to wail on us if we can't deliver.
Oh, I'm not giving up on the job,
said Lola, placing a forefinger against her cheek.
In fact, I think it looks better than ever for us, with the father here as well as the son. That gives us two likely targets instead of just one. And it boosts our chances another way, too. Because there are twice as many of them to guard, there's more chance for their security to slip up. We've got to study the situation just a little more, and then I'll come up with a plan.
You'll come up with a plan, said Ernie. It was your brilliant plan that backfired the first time and got us in this mess to begin with. Why don't I ever get to make the fucking plans?
Because you'd fark 'em up, said Lola bluntly. I mean, I won't claim everything's been a screaming success or any other kind so far, but if you'd been in charge, we'd both be behind bars somewhere, assuming Mr. V and his goons didn't catch with us first.
Ernie scowled. That reminds me. I never did figure out why, if Mr. V and whoever he works for...
Which, believe me, you don't want to know,
interjected Lola.
Okay, okay, said Ernie. But tell me this. If those wise guys can run us down any place we escape to, why the hell do they need us to snatch Willard Fool? Why don't they just go snatch him themselves?
Lola shook her head.
You really don't understand that? Just think about it. What goes wrong if we get caught?
If we're lucky, we get a vacation on some prison colony making rocks into sand, said Ernie. If we're unlucky, we get made into sand.
That's about right, said Lola. But the people who are springing for us to kidnap Fool have got a lot to lose, so they're deflecting the risk by hiring us and making sure there's no paper trail back to them. And that's why we can't afford to know who they are, because if we do, we're too dangerous.
Hey, dangerous? That's me, all right, said Ernie, puffing up his chest and striking a muscle man pose.
Yeah, well, just be careful you don't get yourself in more trouble than you can get out of,
said Lola, exasperated.
These people play rough, or have you forgotten that?
All right, you win, said Ernie. But this time, if I don't think the plan's gonna work, I'm gonna let you know up front. I'm not as stupid as you think.
Oh, you couldn't be,
said Lola, smiling broadly. Before Ernie could figure that out, she added,
But for now, I need you to stay out of sight and relax. I've got to run out and do some spying.
Spying? On who?
Why, the big bird and the little bird,
said Lola, opening the door and turning back to face Ernie.
And with a little bit of luck, we may even catch them both.
Before Ernie could come up with an answer to that, she was out the door and gone. Fool was pleased to see that Mustache had the rescue party lined up in good order near the camp perimeter. He was even more pleased to see how many of the company had turned out on such short notice, fully equipped and ready for action. But that posed a problem in its own right. Taking the bulk of his available force into an unknown situation was risking disaster.
All right, people, listen up, he said. We're going to break into two parties. One will go with me to see what's happening out there in the desert. The other is going to guard the camp in case there is some kind of diversion. Lieutenant Armstrong will command that party.
Fool quickly chose a dozen legionnaires to join him in the rescue party. There were plenty of volunteers to choose from. Every single legionnaire present wanted to go to the aid of their comrades. Fool made it a point to include the three Gambolts, whose speed and fighting ability would be a particular asset against an unknown threat. But he was careful to leave a core of proven legionnaires with Armstrong, not only to protect against a surprise attack, but to act as a reserve rescue party in case his group couldn't finish the job. He didn't think that was going to be necessary. On the other hand, he didn't think a red flare was going to be necessary either, but he had one in his belt.
All right, people, he said. The plan is to get out there as quickly as we can, so we'll take the personnel carrier. When we're about 100 meters short, I want you three Gambolts to get off and scout ahead on foot. We'll come in at walking speed behind you. If any of you signals or if there's any sign of danger, we'll pick up speed again and do whatever we need to. Since we don't know what we're getting into, be alert for my orders. Any questions?
I have a question, sir,
said Mahatma, raising his hand. The little recruit's round face had its usual mellow expression, which, in combination with the raised hand, almost always spelled trouble. Fool mentally chastised himself. He should have remembered Mahatma's tendency to question everything a superior said to him, but he'd already opened that door by choosing the little recruit for the rescue team, so he had no choice but to deal with what came through it.
"Yes, Mahatma, what is it?"
he asked as patiently as he could manage.
"I notice that we are heading in the direction of the AEIOU inspector's camp," said Mahatma.
Should we not warn them that we are about to mount an operation in their vicinity?
Actually, that makes sense, said Fool, nodding. He lifted his wrist communicator to his mouth, buzzed Mother, and quickly relayed Mahatma's suggestion to her.
Tell them to keep their heads down, he added. If we have to engage in combat, there could be danger to civilians in the neighborhood.
Sure, sweetie cakes, said Mother, but wouldn't it be so much better just